Hey, what about this for a joke for the podcast intro? Two Motorolas meet, fall in love, and get married. The wedding wasn't much, but the reception was excellent.
You should have texted me that joke, mate.
Why?
Because then I wouldn't be close enough to throw my phone at you.
Hey, settle down, Rusty.
Hello, this is show number 2 of The Atomic Show, brought to you by Rod Adams from Annapolis, Maryland, and Shane Brown from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Listen in as we talk about biodiesel, alcohol, and diving in New Mexico.
How's the sound coming from me, by the way? Is it a little loud? Do you need me to turn the gain down?
Actually, the sound looks pretty good from you. But if you could turn the gain down just to match up with me, that'd be good.
Okay. I've got the gain back down to about 50%. How's that?
Looks good. Hey, okay. I like your little icon here with the flippers.
It's the closest I could get to a diver icon, and it was one of the professionally done Apple icons, so I figured I'd go with that. Of course, my fins are much, much, much bigger than that.
Okay.
As so are my feet.
Shane, you got to share with all the listeners how one can be a diver from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
We can probably get into that, and it will not involve putting on equipment and going and making sand angels.
So tell us.
It's an interesting story. So you want me to go into it now, or do you want to do it? Okay. So for most of my life, I've been growing up around divers, and I'd always wanted to learn how to scuba dive, but on all the times that I lived near water, I either didn't have the money or I didn't have the time. And when I finally made it out here to Albuquerque and got a job that was decent paying enough that I could go out on the weekends and do things and have the money to be able to buy equipment, I looked around town and there are actually 3 scuba diving shops in town. Went into one of them, said, "I've been wanting to learn how to dive for a long, long time. Can you help me?" They said, "Sure." And about a month later, I was newly certified. And in the last year, I've had about 40 dives. And most of those dives have been in New Mexico. And most of the places that there are in New Mexico to go diving, like, for instance, the place down in Roswell that I mentioned is a wonderful place to go diving called Bottomless Lakes. That gets its name from an old cowboy legend about some good old boys who went out there with some rope and tried tying their lassos together to reach the bottom of the lake, and they never did, and that's why they call it Bottomless. That, and they couldn't see the bottom because it's kind of silty. And then there are other places in New Mexico. There's a place about 2 hours drive east of Albuquerque called the Blue Hole in Santa Rosa. It's right on Route 66. And that place is phenomenal, especially if you go on a quiet, when it's really quiet, because there are divers who come in from all over the Southwest. There are people who come from as far from here as Kansas and Colorado. And if you go there on a quiet day, like on Thanksgiving or day after Thanksgiving, and you go in, the water clarity is such that you can see straight to the bottom, 80 feet. It's like being suspended on wires. The water clarity is simply something you have to see to believe.
Okay, so what do you see in 80 feet of water in New Mexico? I don't imagine there's a lot of coral reefs or anything.
No, but the reason why I like to dive in New Mexico, besides keeping my skills up to date, that's the primary reason, is also because the conditions here can get pretty hairy, in the sense of being really low visibility, cold water, especially in the summertime when you go out there and there's 30, 40, 50, 60 divers in the water at a given time, the entire place is like a giant glass of Alka-Seltzer. Learning how to dive comfortably and not get freaked out in conditions like that makes it much, much more relaxing to go when you're spending real money to go someplace like the Caribbean or Southern California. And that's what happened with us. I mean, we spent 3 days on a dive boat in just off the coast of Los Angeles last July. And for 3 days, I mean, we had a ball. I mean, it was other than salt water, and being constantly on the verge of seasick, being seasick, I actually had a great time. And it was because of all the time that I'd spent in getting really familiar with my equipment to the point where it was just becomes like breathing, which it has to be, so to speak.
Well, breathing is always a good thing, even when you're
yes.
underwater.
Although, based on your stories of how many tours of duty you've done on submarines, I think you have me on sheer time underwater.
Yeah, I've got most people beat on sheer time underwater. 12 patrols on SSBNs, that's probably about 75 days a shot. And most of the time, we didn't come up.
SSBNs don't do very good at their mission if they wander around on the surface.
No, it's too easy to find us on the surface. But anyway, hey, last episode, we got cut off at the end because I had improperly set GarageBand. And I think you asked a question about
gas liquids. Yep.
And the question you asked was, what's my opinion on that? And basically, a little bit about gas liquids technology. It's natural gas has a nice burnable capability, but it's fairly low density. And one of the issues that natural gas has around the world is that some of it gets stranded because it's in a place where there's not a big market for something that's burnable.
Mm-hmm.
So gas to liquid is simply a way to increase the density of the gas and make it more transportable, make it something that you can move in a tanker or in a pipeline with a little bit more efficiency than a gas pipeline.
And so, with not nearly the infrastructure necessary to put in pipelines and deal with environmental impact statements along the entire length and buy up property and all the other wonderful things that go with pipelines.
Yeah, and it's just it takes a lot to lay a pipeline, and then of course once you lay it, you've got to keep going back and maintaining it and all that good stuff. So there's an operational cost of a pipeline. There's also an operational cost in terms of keeping it, the gas compressed and flowing through the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a good source of carbon around, a gas to liquids plant works pretty well. It's probably a little bit less expensive and certainly more flexible than the liquefied natural gas that requires a large amount of refrigeration infrastructure.
So you would consider that gas liquid processes like, for instance, Fischer-Tropsch, and of course my German is pathetic, so any German listeners who are listening can email in with the proper pronunciation, but it was a process that was developed by the Germans during World War II, just before World War II, and enabled them to produce liquid fuel, high-density liquid fuels like gasoline and diesel from carbon feedstocks like coal, which Germany has an abundance of and still does. Would you consider those targets for gas to liquid as opposed to making something like methanol or more of an alcohol-based fuel to be probably the better way to go just because of energy density?
Well, normally the Fischer-Tropsch process is considered to be a solid to liquid process. It's normally used in a place that's got lots of coal and needs to have liquid fuels. And as you've mentioned, Germany in World War II did it, and South Africa during the apartheid embargo era built a plant that they still operate today to convert coal into oil.
It also has the wonderful benefit of not spewing the side products, the byproducts of coal into the atmosphere. You can capture them rather than dumping them up the stack.
Yes, it helps to gather all the byproducts and makes them into a far more useful stream of products that can be used for concrete manufacture, selling off the sulfur, those kinds of things.
Neat. Well, in terms of liquid fuels, there's certainly an awful lot of buzz, so to speak, going on the internet with alcohol fuels. And I think it might be instructive for our listeners to hear the nuclear take on the State of the Union address concerns with new ways of producing ethanol, and some of the history of the industry. I think that was where we might have wanted to go with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of places to go with that. Let me start off by first saying that when it comes to all kinds of processes that require heat to convert something into a liquid fuel, there is a role for nuclear power to play there, since nuclear power is a good, inexpensive, abundant source of clean heat. The ethanol industry in the United States has always been one that's fraught with government subsidies. And I'm not a big fan of government subsidies and government selection of winners and losers in any industry. But the ethanol industry in particular has about 30 years worth of history that shows that if you spend several tens of billions of dollars, you can create an industry that produces a few million gallons of alcohol every year using a large amount of corn and prop up the price of corn and help the stock price of one large producer, namely Archer Daniels.
Archer Daniels Midland. Yeah, I found a few articles when I was looking up stuff on Monday night and thinking about the next show. There was a particularly scathing article on the Cato Institute's website where they go into exhaustive detail on the history of the sheer magnitude of the subsidies that ADM gets. It's mind-boggling that they've gotten as much as they have.
Interestingly enough, a new source of plant-derived fuel has appeared recently in the vernacular and in the marketplace. I keep hearing more and more about biodiesel. And since I drive a diesel-powered car, that's something that I'm always interested in hearing about.
Mm.
What's your take so far on that?
I've heard the economics and definitely energy density on biodiesel is better, and the process for making it certainly a whole lot simpler and in some ways easier to scale up. There is, for instance, in Mississippi, where I spent 11 years, there is an enormous soybean industry, and they are understandably interested in the technology as a potential market for all the soybean oil that they produce as a byproduct of producing animal feed and the like. Biodiesel, from everything that I've seen, it seems to be a good deal, except when if you start thinking about how you're going to manufacture such a large quantity of fuel that you could potentially make an impact on the diesel demand in the United States. It's not a question of whether the fuel can work. I mean, from all I've heard, biodiesel is practically one-to-one equivalent, or maybe 90 or 95% equivalent, but to regular petrodiesel in terms of energy content. The question is how large the resource space is and whether you could conceivably make a dent. And that's where my concern with it comes from. And it's even more so, my concern is even stronger on ethanol.
So, have you seen any kind of calculations anywhere on the quantity of land that is needed to grow X number of gallons of biodiesel? Have you seen any kind of calculations on that?
I have, and I don't think I want to try to pull any numbers out of the air because, number one, I'm not closely familiar with them. I can find them with a Google search. And if I sit down and get a farmer's almanac, or not farmer's almanac, a decent reference with how much material is produced, which is capable of producing vegetable oil or animal oil. You can also produce biodiesel from animal fat. You could sit down and run the numbers and get a decent back of the envelope calculation. But I've not seen any numbers other than the industry boosters for biodiesel saying, oh, there's plenty. As a matter of fact, there was a story on one of the nightly news broadcasts I was watching a few days ago where Willie Nelson is now going around and he is hooked up with a couple of biodiesel manufacturers and they're selling biodiesel under the name of Bio Willie.
Yeah, I think I've heard something about some of the other country music singers that are getting involved in biodiesel. And from what I also heard, that it is quite a celebrity fad out in California to have a automobile powered by biodiesel.
Nothing quite makes for a conversation statement as pulling up to a place in your car, like a fast food joint, and saying, give us your grease and we'll take it off your hands. There, for the last 5 years or so, I've heard of numerous people being able to just drive up to whatever fast food joint is available and buy up some of their old beat up grease that has lots of food particles in it, strain it out enough, and put it through the process.
Yeah, the process, a car that smells like French fries or something.
Yep, and it produces a smell like French fries or donuts or fried chicken, depending upon where the oil was used. And any exhaust that smells like something that you would eat, and an exhaust that would actually make you hungry, definitely gets my opinion up about the technology. But again, this, anything that Hollywood turns into a fad, I'm automatically suspicious of, just on that basis.
Yeah, well, it also seems like there are a number of folks whose consciences are assuaged by using something like biodiesel. You know, they feel guilty about driving, so they figure if they use something like that, it's better. But it's difficult when you start running the numbers. To imagine what kind of quantity of land would have to be dedicated to growing the fuel stocks for the whole country.
Yeah, it's one thing.
The number of drivers on the road in Washington, D.C. every morning, I just can't imagine powering a significant portion of our fuel demand with grown crops.
Yeah.
Of course, and there's also the other problem of there are quite a few hungry people left in the world, and having Americans growing a bunch of food and then burning it doesn't seem quite moral to me.
As wonderful as uranium is, you can't eat it.
There's not many other uses for uranium other than using it in a fission reactor that I can think of. I guess you can probably cover a few glazed plates with it, but I think those have been taken off the market.
Yeah, and really my interest does lie with reactors more so than any other application.
So what is it that really got you enthusiastic about nuclear power? You talked a little bit about how long you've been interested in nuclear power before, but what really catches your attention? What gets your passion up? What makes you an atomic geek?
The concept that I can hold in my hand the equivalent of several rail cars full of coal, or carry in a backpack the equivalent of an oil supertanker of energy, just sitting there, slowly disintegrating a few atoms at a time, and waiting for human ingenuity to come along and realize, you know, if you take this material and stack it a certain way, you get power.
Yeah, massive quantities of power.
And numerous people have said this, but it bears repeating. Any technology which is capable of pushing a 90,000-ton supercarrier through the water into the wind at 30 knots while it's launching airplanes is, while it's consuming about 7 pounds of fuel a day, is a non-trivial, certainly not a wind-powered vessel.
No, not hardly. There's an awful lot that's fascinating about this stuff. That I tell you, the thing that gets me, and I can't understand why people who call themselves environmentalists, who care about clean air and water, will not sometimes listen when I say that it's clean enough to run inside a sealed submarine. That's fascinating to me.
It is, but these are also the same. That particular cohort of people, the same kind of people who go out and buy biodiesel and put in conversion kits in their cars to run ethanol that they produce out of kitchen scraps at home with a modified moonshine still. There are people who do that. These people prefer to, again, I have this tendency, and it's built up by years of learning how to be bitter, to overgeneralize about people, and I'll stop that. But let me go into my point and say that people don't like to run the numbers. They would much rather do something that feels good in their heart than to sit down and realize, you know, it's nice that I'm doing this, but really it doesn't make a lick of difference. And it's that attitude that we're dealing with when people won't listen about the fact that you can take a core, you know, I don't know the exact dimensions, and I don't want to know, a core of the of
well,
fuel.
I can't tell you either, so there you go.
I know how that goes, believe me.
I can tell you exactly how big it is, but I, from memory, but not allowed to say.
Bigger than a bread basket, smaller than a car.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, something of that size and that scale, something on the order size of a human being, can go into a submarine, stay there for 15, 20, 25 years, keeping all its waste contained in one place, and then when it's done, the waste is no bigger in volume than the original fuel. The entire time, all the sailors on board getting pushed around, having all their meals cooked, all their water heated for showers, all the electricity they can burn, pretty much unlimited power. And yet people won't see past the first application of nuclear energy.
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of folks in the nuclear world will say that and say, well, geez, if we hadn't done a bomb first, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when you look back in history, right after the bomb was exploded was when people were the most enthusiastic about beating those swords into plowshares and making that incredible amount of energy that was so obviously there into something useful for humans.
There are some interesting stories about Project Plowshare, by the way. I don't know. We'll get to this sometime, but I've made it a point to go several places where Project Plowshare type programs were going on. Or I would like to go, for instance, up in the northeast or northwest corner of New Mexico. There was a project that was done about 30 years ago where they did a natural gas stimulation. And for obvious reasons, or obvious reasons to people who pay attention to economics and keeping government involvement to a minimum, and never went anywhere, but it was an interesting idea.
Well, we will talk about Plowshare on another occasion, but just for those listeners who were wondering and curious, Operation Plowshare was literally a program by the U.S. government to use nuclear explosives for things that conventional explosives are often used for in commercial enterprises. So we'll get back to Plowshare sometime in the not-too-distant future. But, you know, here's another thing that I have to keep bringing up every time I talk to folks, and because I figure repetition is valuable, and, you know, there's a good reason why advertisers keep paying for slots on television and keep saying the same things over and over again. So I'll say it here, and you can dispute it or what, but it seems to me that the success of the folks opposed to nuclear energy is pretty obvious. For about 30 years, they were able to slow down and in fact, stop the development of an industry that was making some really significant strides in producing useful, clean, and fairly inexpensive energy for people. And it seems to me that the reason that success existed was not because it was led by people who want to make biodiesel in their backyard or who believe that they should live off the grid for the rest of their lives. I think that success was supported by some very powerful sources around the world, because let's face it, the fossil industry is the world's first globalized industry. It is the world's largest industry even today. And when you have a new source coming in, taking market share from an existing enterprise, that new source is going to get some opposition.
Machiavelli said it best. The hardest thing to take in hand is the development of a new enterprise, because you have only lukewarm defenders and those who would benefit if you succeed. I'm paraphrasing here. And vehement opponents and those who have something to lose. And that advice holds true in spades with nuclear power. Really, Machiavelli is one of the better people to read when you're dealing with how to break the stranglehold that the fossil fuel companies have and have continued to have for 30, 40, however long they've been in the situation where they're pulling in multi-billion dollar profits per quarter.
Your memory is far too short. The fossil fuel industry has been the world's most powerful and globalized industry since about 1840 or so, when we started burning coal and industrializing the world. I mean, the industrial age, although sometimes referred to as the age of steam, was definitely the age of fossil fuel, because steam didn't make itself.
Right.
I mean, steam is not a source of power. It's simply a means of converting power into something useful. The power came from burning fossil fuels.
Yep. And then 10 years after that, a fellow by the name of Drake got called an idiot for drilling for what people thought was a useless gunk that came out of the ground in western Pennsylvania. And look where we are 150 years later.
But, you know, interestingly enough, it wasn't but a few years after Drake actually made it big and people started realizing that burning this oil coming out of the ground was better than killing whales, that we hit the first oil crisis. And the first oil crisis was not a crisis of insufficient supply, but a crisis of insufficient number of barrels to transport the material. And it was gushing out of the ground so fast that people were having to burn it off.
And my cup runneth over.
Exactly. I think the price got down to about 10 cents a barrel or something, because there was not enough people making barrels to be able to put it away.
That's incredible. That's certainly not a fact that you run across every day, unless you go looking.
Well, you know, I've got a little library of weird facts about the energy industry. As somebody once told me, it's best to, if you have an obsession, it's best to stick with it.
You'll eventually either make something of it or, well, at least you'll have wonderful stories to tell.
Well, you know, wonderful stories amongst those who care, stories that make people's eyes roll up behind their head if they don't really care much. So, hey, one of the reasons I started talking to folks on this podcast is because, you know, the wife and kids are getting pretty darn tired of hearing about energy from the atomic geek. So, anyway.
My wife is much the same, and has a trained chemical engineer. She definitely, I get some serious eye rolling from time to time, although it becomes more of my experiments with computer programming. And, hey, look what I can do. But
now, so your wife is a chemical engineer by training. Does she do that as a profession?
She is doing materials testing as a current trade. And basically, she puts various samples of organic materials through thermal analysis to determine their properties and see whether you can make a decent adhesive from them or decent insulator or things like that. It's just turning out new products and new ideas for products.
I love new ideas for products. Well, Shane, I think it's about time to wrap it up tonight because I have nothing else I really want to talk about, although there's some really exciting news coming from the nuclear industry on a daily basis. Next week, we'll get back together and chat some more and keep trying to share our enthusiasm about this kind of esoteric subject.
All right. Well, as a lead-in for next week, perhaps, I saw on the blog, on the Atomic Insights blog, that the story, the mention that was made about reprocessing, that turned into an 8-comment thread, which was, that was a fairly large number of people commenting in a short period of time. So reprocessing, especially nowadays with the new processes coming up, that might be a worthwhile place to go next week, aka why reprocessing should be called recycling.
Now that's a good thought. And you also reminded me, let's do a little cross promoting here. Although I just started this podcast, the podcast is only part of the Atomic Geek Empire here. I've been writing and thinking about atomic energy for a number of years and have a website that's been on the web continuously since 1995, celebrated our 10th anniversary last fall. And that's at www.atomicinsights.com. And there is a new blog we started this summer, www.atomicinsights.blogspot.com. And if you're on either of those sites, you can also find links to a rather unusual little company called Adams Atomic Engines Incorporated. And at some point, we'll probably talk about what Adams Atomic Engines does and what kind of technologies we would like to see developed in the small or relatively small power market.
Well, that would be an interesting show for sure. And especially in the sense of, for instance, a link I was reading that you passed me earlier that I was reading and someone going out on a limb and saying, well, that by 2050 there might be as many as 1,000 nuclear reactors. And I just immediately the quote sprang to mind of the president of IBM 60 years ago saying, well, there might be a market for 5 computers worldwide.
Well, you know, at some point we will talk about my vision of the corollary between moving from mainframes to VAXes to mini computers down to microcomputers and hopefully the same or similar transition in the nuclear world from gigantic centralized power plants down to mini power plants, size for a village or a ship, and maybe even down to micro power plants at some point down the road.
It would be certainly an interesting road to see how we can get that to come about.
All right, Shane. Well, take care. Have a good evening, and talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good week.
Hey, wait. Hello? Dude, I'm like trapped in this podcast and I'm really hungry and like, you know, it was brought to you by like Motorola, you know, I'm like really hungry. So could you like download some burritos, and maybe your shake or something and dump it on your music player? 'Cause I'm stuck in here and I really need to pee. So if you could download a bucket or something too and some air freshener, that would be sweet, dude. Thanks.